Nuclear. It's the pits. Plutonium pits, that is. The explosive core required for every nuclear weapon to have the devastating impact that it does. The United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission has approved and work has started to create two facilities to build new plutonium pits for more bombs at the Savannah River site in South Carolina and Los Alamos National Laboratory near Santa Fe, New Mexico. But opposition to these facilities, this plan, and the money hog that it represents, a number of organizations have joined together to launch a lawsuit to stop them, with some major recent success. What's wrong with this scheme to increase plutonium pit production? It takes a genuine expert with decades of experience in fighting nukes to clearly explain.
No future plutonium pit production is to maintain the safety and reliability of our existing nuclear weapon stockpile that has been extensively tested. Instead, future pit production is for speculative new designs that will change or may even prompt the U.S. to resume testing.
Well, when Jay Coughlin of Nuke Watch New Mexico spells out this and so many other reasons to oppose plutonium pit production, and the U.S. federal court has just agreed that the current plan violates federal law, you gotta look at the battle to prevent a major expansion of that deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we examine a recent federal court ruling that pauses the forward rush of nuclear interests to make more plutonium pits for more megabombs. We talk with Jay Coughlin. He is executive director of NukeWatch New Mexico, which since 1999 has been a watchdog group that seeks to promote safety and environmental protection at regional nuclear facilities, and so much more, as you will learn. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than mainstream media has been covering in connection with the recent hurricanes. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 8, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. This is a late-breaking story that came in just as we were about to post this week's episode. Mary Olson of Gender and Radiation Impact Project is safe and well. She lives in Asheville, North Carolina, and we had not heard from her since Hurricane Helene ripped through that city on September 27. Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear reports that Mary is fine. She has water, food, cell phone, but no internet connection. She has been hosting folks from around the community at her house for showers and laundry services and is very lucky considering the circumstances of others. That just made my day. Speaking of hurricanes, there are three nuclear power plant sites in Florida that stand to be impacted by Hurricane Milton. They are Turkey Point with two reactors just south of Miami, St. Lucie with two reactors further north on the east coast of Florida between Fort Pierce and Port St. Lucie, and Crystal River on the west coast of Florida, 79 miles north of Tampa. Crystal River was shut down in 2013, but highly radioactive fuel rods are still stored on site. The two operating power plants, with two units each, St. Lucie and Turkey Point, have both been hit by hurricanes before and lost off-site power, which is very dangerous for a nuclear power plant. Nuclear reactors do not power themselves. If their diesel backup generators fail or run out of fuel, they are hours away from a nuclear meltdown as the cooling water boils off and can expose the fuel rods to the air. In the past, backup generators have worked at both these plants, and Turkey Point made it 5 days without off-site power after Hurricane Andrew in 1992. As the Union of Concerned Scientists points out, their generator building is within falling distance of a smokestack at the same power plant that was severely cracked by winds during Hurricane Andrew. And Turkey Point has also been fined for falsifying repair records on safety equipment. We wish all of them and the people of Florida safe journey through the coming weather. And following up on Hurricane Helene, Crystal River was hit with a storm surge of 8 feet. And according to a report filed by plant owner Duke Energy, the whole site was flooded, including buildings, sumps, and lift stations. Industrial wastewater pond number 5 was observed overflowing to the ground due to the surge. An excellent rundown on what the warnings were that came from Hurricane Helene towards the nuclear plants was written by Linda Pence Gunter and appears in Beyond Nuclear International, entitled Hurricane Helene Sends a Warning. We will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 694. On September 30th, United States District Court Judge Mary Geiger Lewis ruled that the United States Department of Energy and its semi-autonomous nuclear weapons agency, the National Nuclear Security Agency, violated the National Environmental Policy Act by failing to properly consider alternatives before proceeding with plans to produce plutonium pits, a critical component of nuclear weapons, at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico and the Savannah River site in South Carolina. Today's featured interview with Jay Coughlin will focus on these issues and explore them thoroughly. And regarding the proposed restart of the Palisades nuclear reactor in Michigan, a Safe Energy Watchdog Coalition has filed a petition to intervene with the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and requested a hearing in opposition to Holtec International's unprecedented and unneeded Palisades nuclear power plant restart scheme on Lake Michigan's southeast shore. The petition, backed by expert witness Arnold Gunderson, chief engineer of Fairwinds Associates Incorporated, warns of the extreme risks to safety, security, health, and the environment resulting from the more than 50-year-old atomic reactor's severe age-related degradation, as well as its owners, Holtec's, utter inexperience operating a nuclear plant. The coalition filing the petition includes Beyond Nuclear, Don't Waste Michigan, Michigan Safe Energy Future, Nuclear Energy Information Service of Chicago, and 3 Mile Island Alert of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Terry Lodge of Toledo, Ohio, and Wallace Taylor of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, serve as the coalition's legal counsel. We will link to the press release that goes into all the details. Moving over to Japan, where now it's time for
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
At the remains of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan, which suffered a triple meltdown in 2011 after a major tsunami, attempts to retrieve radioactive debris from the ruins continue to fail. Most recently, the cameras attached to a device used to retrieve this debris from the nuclear power plant are now believed by Tokyo Electric Power Company, the operator and owner of the site, as having failed due to overcurrent caused by strong radiation. In other words, the radiation levels were so hard, the equipment fried. This is something that we've been saying on Nuclear Hot Seat, and others in the community who pay attention to these things have been saying for the longest times. Now, in an attempt to fix the problem, Tokyo Electric Power, or TEPCO, has moved the cameras into a metal containment box outside the reactor containment vessel. The good news is that no abnormalities were visible on their exteriors. The bad news is they're still not working. So TEPCO, relying on high-tech modern engineering right at the cutting edge, is trying to restore the cameras by turning them off and turning them on remotely at intervals of a few days. That's like saying you've got a 1990s computer that you have to reboot every time it freezes by turning it off and then turning it on. That's the best they've got. Why don't they use the trick that worked for 1950s television sets? Just smack it upside and see if the tubes rattle around until they work. If worst comes to worst, and considering this is nuclear, and it's TEPCO, and it's Fukushima, there is no prospect of resuming operations until the cameras are replaced, which TEPCO only says they may need to be replaced. And this is a country and a company working hard to restart nuclear reactors all over the country when they can't even get to the core of what happened to the three that melted down. And that's why Tokyo Electric Power Company, once again and for a record number of times, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Japan and 11 other countries have agreed to work together to launch negotiations immediately on a proposed treaty banning the production of fissile materials, which are required for nuclear weapons, including highly enriched uranium and plutonium. A fissile material cutoff treaty will significantly contribute to nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation. The 12 countries included three nuclear powers, the United States, Britain, and France, and issued a statement which said, "A non-discriminatory, multilateral, and effectively verifiable treaty banning the production of fissile material for nuclear weapons and other nuclear explosive devices would represent a significant practical contribution to nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation efforts." In the better late than never category, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said that people who experienced the 1945 atomic bombing of Nagasaki but were not certified as hibakusha victims will receive medical assistance equivalent to that given to the hibakusha, which are those who survived the A-bomb attack. The individuals had been disqualified because they were exposed to radiation outside the state-designated zone. Kind of like downwinders trying to get RECA, Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, benefits when they live in New Mexico or other areas excluded from RECA coverage so far. In international nuclear saber-rattling, Russia has placed nuclear-capable strategic missile launchers on combat duty. This according to Russian news agency TASS, which reported that the readiness of personnel and equipment for long-term duty in the field were being checked. And North Korean leader Kim Jong-un warned again that he could use nuclear weapons in potential conflicts with South Korea and the United States, as he accused them of provoking North Korea and raising animosities on the Korean Peninsula. This according to North Korean state media. Kim has issued similar threats to use nuclear weapons preemptively numerous times, but his latest warning came as outside experts say North Korea could ramp up hostilities ahead of next month's U.S. presidential election. In a speech on Monday, October 7, Kim said North Korea, quote, "will without hesitation use all its attack capabilities against its enemies if they attempt to use armed forces against North Korea. The use of nuclear weapons is not ruled out in this case." We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, I know you care about getting honest nuclear news. And that's what we set out to do here at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Provide you with verifiable nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you about people on the front lines of activism around the world, their triumphs, challenges, and how you can help. We get underneath the manicured exterior of mainstream media's nuclear stories to provide context and continuity, because we want you to understand what the issues are, what we're up against, and what any of us can do about it. But this show cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from Nuclear Hot Seat, now is the time to help us out with a donation. That's what we run on. And right now, quite frankly, our expenses are far outstripping what we've been sent. So if you've ever thought of donating to Nuclear Hot Seat as a good idea, but you haven't done so yet, now is the exact right time to follow through. All donations are tax deductible because Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization. So just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a red donate button. Click on it and follow the prompts. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. The need is right now. So go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening, that you care, and thanks for being part of the fight against nuclear. Now, here's this week's featured interview. U.S. District Court Judge Mary Geiger Lewis ruled last week that the United States Department of Energy, the DOE, and its semi-autonomous nuclear weapons agency, the National Nuclear Security Administration, or NNSA, violated the National Environmental Policy Act by failing to properly consider alternatives before proceeding with their plans to produce the core components of all nuclear weapons at both Los Alamos National Laboratory in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Savannah River Site in South Carolina. This ruling comes as a result of a suit filed by a coalition of plaintiffs consisting of Savannah River Site Watch, Nuclear Watch New Mexico, and Tri-Valley Cares, which is located near the Lawrence Livermore Labs in Northern California. How did this suit come about? And what does this ruling actually mean? To learn more, we spoke with Jay Coughlin. He is executive director of NukeWatch New Mexico, which since 1999 has sought to promote safety and environmental protection at regional nuclear facilities, mission diversification away from nuclear weapons programs, greater accountability and cleanup in the nationwide nuclear weapons complex, and consistent U.S. leadership towards a world free of nuclear weapons. It has successfully addressed nuclear weapons issues across a spectrum of disarmament, nonproliferation, open government, and environmental concerns. In the wake of this recent ruling, I spoke with Jay Coughlin on Monday, October 7, 2024. Jay Coughlin, it's great to have you here on short notice at Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for having me.
There has just been what looks like major development through the courts. Let's start out with some background so people can have the context in which this happened. What has been the situation regarding plutonium pit production at both Los Alamos National Laboratory and Savannah River Site?
For starters, I suppose I should explain what a pit is. And in this case, it's not a hole in the ground. It's like the pit of a peach, which is to say a core. And when we're talking about plutonium pits, we're talking about the plutonium cores of nuclear weapons. Now, the United States lost its capability for industrial scale pit production in 1989 when the FBI raided the Rocky Flats plant near Denver while investigating environmental crimes. So ever since that period of time, way back starting in 1989, the United States has been seeking to reestablish industrial scale plutonium pit production. And I'm trying to be relatively brief, but what the legal case is that I and others have been involved in is there's a federal law called the National Environmental Policy Act. Some call it the Magna Carta of all environmental laws in the United States, signed by Richard Nixon back in 1970. But the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, as the acronym goes, requires the executive branch agencies to offer the public the opportunity to review and comment and have public hearings on major federal proposals. So guess what? The Department of Energy ignored the mandate of that law and did not offer up to the public the chance to analyze and comment on what is the largest, most expensive project of the National Nuclear Security Administration to date, which is the establishment of simultaneous pit production at the Los Alamos Lab in northern New Mexico and the Savannah River site in South Carolina. So that's the gist of the case and background in a nutshell.
Now there has been a federal court ruling that impacts the plans in both these locations. What has just been decided?
What the court found was the fundamental fact that the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is the semi-autonomous nuclear weapons agency within the Department of Energy, the court found that NNSA was in fundamental violation of the federal National Environmental Policy Act.
That sounds like it's a pretty big deal, is it?
It has potential, potential, potential. I'm going to have to say that remains to be seen. The court, in its wisdom, again found that the National Nuclear Security Administration was in violation of NEPA, but then directed both sides, that is to say, we plaintiffs and the defendants, which is the Department of Energy, basically directed both sides of the table to work it out. Now, we'll have to see, A, if it works out at all. And into that process, which originally the court gave us just 2 weeks to do it, the clock started ticking exactly 1 week ago when the court entered its ruling. And the two parties have not even talked to each other yet, although, of course, there's been interior discussion, internal discussion. But just today, the court granted us another 10 days. So this is to say that by October 25th, the two parties are supposed to submit a joint proposal to the court on how to work this out. And I'll repeat, it remains to be seen if it can be worked out. We'll see.
Is there a proposal you can think of that would work? And if there isn't one that either you or the other side can come up with, what happens then?
Well, first of all, I would say it is my job to come up with a proposal that remains to be seen if it'll work. I kind of know what I want, but I'm not going to give that away or discuss that in a public venue while we're in negotiations. Hopefully, there will be a desirable outcome. I repeat that kind of the essence of the National Environmental Policy Act is it's not that federal agencies have to, it's that they must. And must in the legal arena means must. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. So, our basic view, or I'm speaking for we plaintiffs, we're looking to uphold the National Environmental Policy Act, in which federal agencies must give the public opportunity for analysis of major federal proposals and the opportunity to comment on it. Also, this is a little aside on the National Environmental Policy Act. That's the good news about NEPA, is that it requires the government to give the public opportunity for comment. The bad side or the weak side of NEPA is it doesn't require the government to reach good decisions. So, be that as that may be.
It sounds like, as someone outside of the inner workings of this process, that there's going to have to be some accommodation to bring this process in alignment with existing law, with the must that you talk about. If that were to take place, how long a period of time would you expect or would you want to be allocated to the review of the material and the putting it in front of the public and gaining those kind of insights and inputs?
I'll give a little bit more background to the case. And I will note that in 2008, the National Nuclear Security Administration completed a nationwide, what's called programmatic environmental impact statement. Now, that was 16 years ago. And from a legal standpoint, that's what the federal government has been relying upon in all this, saying that our 2008 programmatic environmental impact statement is still good enough, is still relevant. Well, needless to say, in 16 years, a lot has changed, including the fact that the National Nuclear Security Administration decided to have simultaneous plutonium pit production at two sites, that is the Los Alamos Lab and Savannah River site, which obviously is a major change, which the judge so noted. So in answering your question about what is required, and I'm not giving anything away here, but one would think at a minimum that an updated, a current programmatic environmental impact statement on plutonium pit production is needed. Not only needed, I should say that more strongly, is legally required by the National Environmental Policy Act.
This has the potential, if not the already existing reality, to stop the progress that has been made so far in the building of the structures and preparing the ground for plutonium pit production in both these locales. Would the implementation of this need for an updated report shut that down?
That remains to be seen. What I would like to do is to point to the government's rather gross deficiencies in its aggressive proposal to expand plutonium pit production. I'll plug the website of Nuclear Watch New Mexico and recommend that people go to a fact sheet that we have on plutonium pit production, since time is limited here. And you can see our argument why expanded pit production is not only not necessary and is a tremendous waste of taxpayers' money, but this will surprise people, may actually degrade the United States' national security. To briefly touch upon that, I'm just going to rattle off some bullet points. But for more details, your listeners should go to our fact sheet. But if there's any one thing I would like a relatively uninformed member of the public to know and understand about expanded pit production, none of it, and by none, I mean zero, nada, zilch, is to maintain the safety and reliability of the existing, of the now existing nuclear weapon stockpile. Instead, future pit production is all for speculative new design nuclear weapons. And we know that they're going to change the design of the plutonium pits. We know that. We don't know how much, but we know that the designs are going to change. I call your listeners back to the blockbuster movie Oppenheimer. That was all about the test of the first plutonium pit at the Trinity test. That's what the entire movie was about. To add one more little clause, the United States nuclear weapons stockpile over time has had more than 1,000 full-scale tests. So we have an extensive database, an extensive legacy of full-scale nuclear weapons tests. What you don't want to do is to introduce uncertainties into the stockpile, which is reliable, you don't want to introduce uncertainties through design changes when you can't test those weapons. So that's one way it could degrade national security, is by eroding confidence in the reliability of the American nuclear weapons stockpile. Conversely, this could prompt the U.S. to resume testing, after which surely other countries would follow. That too would degrade American national security. So I'm just going to repeat the take-home point. No future plutonium pit production is to maintain the safety and reliability of our existing nuclear weapons stockpile that has been extensively tested. Instead, future pit production is for speculative new designs that will change or may even prompt the U.S. to resume testing.
We are not deprived when it comes to a stockpile of nuclear weapons and plutonium pits. I read in the materials you sent out that we currently have a national inventory of more than 15,000 plutonium pits. I don't know if any of those are counted as the ones being in weapons, or these are just the ones that are stockpiled in a garage somewhere as spare parts. But with that kind of a stockpile, what possible motivation would there be for creating these new pits with the new design?
Multiple motivations. Designing nuclear weapons, that's what's sexy at the nuclear weapons labs, which to wit are Los Alamos, Sandia, and Livermore. Everything else at these multi-billion dollar labs just don't have the prestige and the cachet that, you know, actually designing weapons have. So that's one motivation. Some cynics declare that it's all about the money and the profit motivation of the contractors that run the labs and the production complex. I'm with them, but just not totally. I'm not saying it's only the money, but yes, the profit motivation is definitely a strong incentive in all of this. I'm just going to pick the top three motivations as I think they are. So the third and final motivation is more and more kind of narrowly tailored nuclear weapons. And in general, there's been a drift towards lower yield, but more accurate weapons. And, you know, I can't go down into the weeds too much, but, you know, just to give you some scale, the Hiroshima weapon, generally regarded as being around 20 kilotons in yield, and 20 kilotons, kilo 1,000, that means 20,000, the equivalent of 20,000 tons of TNT. So that's what the Hiroshima weapon was believed to be, around that. So I'm kind of giving you a range, but there are nuclear weapons that are 600 times as powerful as the Hiroshima weapon, if you can imagine that. But then I'm also talking that lately the drift has been towards lower yield, more accurate weapons. And in terms of lower yield, we're talking even a kiloton or below. So quite small nuclear or atomic weapons. Of course, ultimately, there's nothing small about any atomic or nuclear weapon. Now, in terms of accuracy, this is interesting. Your listeners, when I say accuracy, a lot of people would, you know, kind of have a vision of a two-dimensional bullseye or something. And to be accurate is to be more within the bullseye. But with nuclear weapons, we're talking about a bullseye in three dimensions. And that height of burst has a lot of influence on actually how powerful that weapon is. So oddly enough, the most powerful effects from a nuclear weapon won't necessarily happen on the surface, on the ground surface. If a nuclear weapon can slightly penetrate into the earth, it couples, that's the verb that is used, it couples with the geology and reinforces its destructive impact. On the other hand, at the correct burst at a certain altitude, a nuclear weapon creates an overpressure on its target and can have greater destructive effect than if it was a ground burst. So I go down into the weeds a little too much, but again, the underlying point I was trying to get across is there has been a general drift towards lower yield, more accurate weapons. But here comes the bad news. Kind of by definition, they are hence more usable or more likely to be used. You know, I date myself by declaring the obvious. I was a child of the Cold War. I was very much aware of the Cuban Missile Crisis, for which we are facing an anniversary this month. And then Secretary Robert McNamara, well, he said afterwards, we survived the Cuban Missile Crisis only by luck. And I want to impress upon your listeners today that we are in nearly, if not as much danger now as we were then. We are arguably in an even more dangerous and unpredictable nuclear arms race because we now have multiple nuclear actors. It's not just the bipolar arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States. And we also have new cyber and hypersonic weapons and artificial intelligence. So when you add these things on top of former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara saying we survived only by luck, luck is not a sustainable survival strategy for the human race, and we better do better than that.
Of course, there's radioactivity that would be released from any bomb blast, no matter what size, be it a cute little bomb or one of the 600 times bigger than Hiroshima bombs. But there's also the radiation problem that we would face in our local communities at Savannah River site or near Los Alamos of the radioactive waste that gets created in the course of manufacturing these pits. What, if anything, are the major players involved tasked with by this ruling, by the law, regarding what they do with the radioactive waste?
You know, first of all, the defendants, and that is to say the Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration, I'm being literal and narrowly legalistic. They're presently tasked with nothing with this court order. Again, what the court found was that the government is in violation of the National Environmental Policy Act and then directed the two sides of the table to work it out. So we will be busy working things out if they can be worked out. But I will say more than a word or two about the radioactive waste that come from pit production, because this is, first of all, an interesting issue, and secondly, at least I think, is one of their highest points of vulnerability. Exactly where do the radioactive wastes go? I've learned over time to not go down in the weeds too much, to not spout acronyms, but the Department of Energy radioactive waste from nuclear weapons research and production is divided into three broad categories. The first is high-level radioactive waste, a very ingenious name, wouldn't you think? That's reactor waste and from reprocessing for plutonium. Plutonium, after all, is mostly not a natural material and comes from irradiating uranium in reactors. So that stuff is highly radioactive, hence the term high-level radioactive waste. Then there's a middle class called transuranic waste, and that's what we're talking about with plutonium pit production. And the lowest class of waste is, again, original naming, low-level waste. That's what we have. But the issue here with plutonium pit production are the transuranic waste. And there's only one place in the country, and in fact, the world, it can go to for permanent disposal. And wouldn't you know it, they pick on the poor state of New Mexico again. The only place those plutonium pit waste can go to is at a facility called the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in southern New Mexico, where Los Alamos Lab is in northern New Mexico. Now, I'll try to be brief and get to the point. The National Academy of Scientists say that WIP, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, is already oversubscribed for all of the future wastes that DOE, the Department of Energy, wants to stick into it. Further, the state of New Mexico is, my biases will be clear in the following. The state of New Mexico, the state government, is starting to be less of a patsy to the Department of Energy than it has been. And there is, as of last year, a new state permit for the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. First of all, the Department of Energy wanted an indefinite extension. New Mexico mandated that the permit had to be renewed every decade, just for starters. The Environment Department mandated that priority be given to legacy wastes for cleanup.
And by legacy waste, you mean?
Cleanup of old waste from the first arms race before we start producing more waste from the second arms race. And also, the New Mexico Environment Department mandated that DOE has to annually report on its search for a radioactive waste dump outside of the state of New Mexico. So all of this makes the Department of Energy's assumption that it can rely upon the Waste Isolation Pilot Project for disposal of radioactive waste from pit production, which DOE intends to do that until the year 2080, by the way, but really makes DOE's assumption pretty risky. I'll just put it that way. So I have been involved in, I don't know, maybe by now it's a half dozen lawsuits under the National Environmental Policy Act. And I have a little saying I say to myself, you got to remember that the E in NEPA stands for environmental. And you better have some environmental issues instead of just policy issues. So this is to say the issue of future disposal of radioactive waste from pit production is a paramount issue. And it's not clear exactly what DOE would do.
There's obviously going to be a need for extensive follow-up on this. What are the next steps? Is it making the arrangements to actually meet either face-to-face or over Zoom with the interests that want to promote the pit production? Or are there other steps that can be taken at the same time without giving away any of your strategy?
And don't worry, I'm not about to give away strategy. What's the first step? Call the lawyers. And in fact, we plaintiffs conferred with our lawyers today. And of course, it's the Department of Justice representing National Nuclear Security Administration. I have no inside information whatsoever. I'm just betting that they're in quite a tizzy. I'll just put it that way. So you know that they're talking. And also, for any of you lawyers that might be listening out there, I'd like to advertise myself as a good client. I actually let the lawyers do the talking. How about that? Except first, I make sure they say what I want them to say. But I let them do the talking. So the next step is the lawyers getting together. And, you know, we're going to have a proposal from our side. And, you know, to be clear, partially repetitious, but the judge ordered both sides to come up with a joint proposal. And she used that term, a joint proposal. So the two sides have to get together and see if we can hash something out or not. Oh, and by the way, for you wannabe lawyers out there, we filed this case in June 29th, 2021. So it's taken more than 3 years to get to this point, so it's been slow. And I hasten to add that we plaintiffs started writing the National Nuclear Security Administration formal letters. We did five times starting in October 2018. So in effect, we've been at this for 6 years now, and we never did get a response, not even a response of any kind from the National Nuclear Security Administration. And now we get this favorable ruling. On a humorous note, a deputy manager of the Savannah River site submitted a declaration. And, you know, in these declarations, you got to, it's the proverbial raise your right hand. You know, you promise to not perjure yourself. You know, this deputy manager of the Savannah River site, he said, oh, if work stops, it's going to cost the government an extra $3 billion. I'm going to have to lay off 1,400 workers. My response, this is not to sound cynical, but tough. We started writing you 6 years ago, and you never even responded to us. And the other thing I'd like to point out is the judge referred to this. She referred to that declaration, and you know, I don't know the judge, but it seems like she has a sense of humor. She referred to the Departments of Energy's, and this is in quote, parade of horribles, according to them, you know, $3 billion, 1,400 workers laid off. But she twice, she told the parties to go work it out. And here's what's interesting. She did this twice. She basically said, go work it out, keeping in mind plaintiff's request for injunctive relief. She said that twice.
And explain what injunctive relief means.
That's when you actually go in and start stopping things until such a date as something else is complied with. I don't want to read too much into that, but again, she said it, wrote it in her order twice. So that's interesting. And should put the fear of God into NNSA.
So say both sides come to the table, you do your best to come up with a joint proposition, and what you have in effect is a hung jury. You can't come to a conclusion. What happens then when you go back to the judge and say, we haven't come up with a conclusion?
That would be up to the judge. And, you know, what you outlined there is not an unlikely scenario. We'll just have to see. I repeat, you know, we got to submit something 2 weeks from now. So it has a short timeline.
Is there a higher court or a higher entity in the United States than the U.S. District Court that could potentially change or modify or overrule this ruling?
Of course there is. And it's called the United States Supreme Court. And should that happen, just expect the Chicken Little cries over national security. I'm trying to reach more for the chicken analogy. Huh? Well, it'll be roosters screeching national security or whatever, should this case go to the Supreme Court, which is not impossible.
It sounds like you have a lot of work ahead of you. We will, of course, link to your website and the PDF that you mentioned that will give people the fact sheet. Is there anything else you can think of you'd like us to know at this time?
Yes, I would like your listeners to know that the nonprofit legal organization in South Carolina that is representing us, and by name, they are the South Carolina Environmental Law Project. They are terrific. They are very good. They're doing this work on recovery, and, you know, hopefully they do indeed get some recovery for their time soon.
When you say recovery, you mean monetary compensation.
That is correct. There's a difference between recovery and pro bono. Pro bono literally translates for free. Recovery, in contrast, means the lawyers get paid if they win, which is always good incentive. But I just want to say that the South Carolina Environmental Law Project has been terrific. I also need to give a tip of the hat to fellow co-plaintiffs, which is Savannah Riverside Watch in Columbia, South Carolina. Tom Clements, who, by the way, is also named as an individual plaintiff. And it turned out that his naming as an individual plaintiff was crucial for standing purposes as well. Lawyers will know what I mean by that. Another plaintiff was Tri-Valley Communities Against a Radioactive Environment based in Livermore, California. So kudos to them. Of interest, the Gulagachi organization, but they're extremely interesting. They are a historic Black community. A lot of them are freedom fighters. That's what I call them, runaway slaves, freedom fighters. Of the Sea Islands off the coast of Georgia and South Carolina. So they are plaintiffs as well. So a nice, diverse set of plaintiffs, both ethnically and geographically across the country. So hats off to my fellow plaintiffs. I'm not looking to be self-serving, but these organizations are worthy of support, fighting the good fight. On a self-interested note, go to nukewatch.org. You can look up the lawsuit. We got all the pleadings, all the briefs up there. You can see that plutonium pit fact sheet, etc. So again, that's NukeWatch, NukeWatch.org.
Jay Coughlin, you've been doing a great job for more years than some of our listeners have been alive. And wish you well on this leg of the journey. Please stay in touch. Let us know if anything changes. And for now, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
I suggest that we ought to get back together in, say, about a month once these negotiations are concluded, and we'll see what final outcomes might be.
Give a shout out. You've got space on the program.
Okay. Thank you, Libby.
That was Jay Coughlin, Executive Director of NukeWatch New Mexico. We will have a link up to the press release regarding Judge Lewis's ruling and also to the plutonium pit fact sheet PDF. Both are on NukeWatch New Mexico and will be linked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 694.
Activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
Here's a big honking piece of good news. Movie Maker Magazine has just named the International Uranium Film Festival one of the coolest film festivals of 2024. This is a major honor from an esteemed publication dealing with films and filmmakers. And you know, a little bit of good news never hurt anyone. We will post a link to a PDF of the full story as it appears in print. And that will be, of course, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 694. In the meantime, if you can get to Los Angeles, the festival is currently set to run in Hollywood, December 7 and 8, in conjunction with Kat Kramer Films That Changed the World, under the name Atomic Age Film Festival. For more information, you can check out the festival at uraniumfilmfestival.org. And keeping with films, the 1983 movie Silkwood is now available on Hulu. It's not been available for many years, so this is an opportunity for people to learn part of her story, of her work with Kerr McGee on a nuclear facility, her discovery of nuclear contamination, and her untimely death in a car accident that has never been fully explained. Her son is on the bandwagon and says that this is the perfect time for people to view the film. It's the 50th anniversary of Silkwood's death, and what she faced back then is not unlike what workers and whistleblowers are facing now. And if you have information or remember the story of Karen Silkwood, you can send an email to silkwood@koco.com. Susie Snyder, of the Nobel Peace Prize winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, is attending the United Nations PRI, Principles in Responsible Investing, this week in Toronto. This is where she's going to meet up with investors who want to make a difference. Members of the financial community are coming together to ensure the 1.5 degrees Celsius climate targets are met, that there are clear protections for biodiversity, and who are making sure the extractives industry's tragic history of human rights horrors is finally put to rest. The UNPRI is a place for these investors to come together and join efforts to make these policies matter. We'll have a link up to more information on the Principles in Responsible Investing program at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode. Actress Jane Fonda is making nuclear news again. The powerhouse performer and producer who was behind the making of China Syndrome, an accident very similar to the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown and hit theaters only 2 weeks before that accident happened, has published an extensive op-ed entitled "Nuclear Power at Three Mile Island is No Climate Solution." And she doesn't just hit the facile easy points in this. It's a really well-done op-ed that hits all the major issues and explains them in very clear and forceful language. Of course, we'll link to it on the website. And the Stop Japan Working Group 2023, which is also known as JNC TV, has just posted two videos of interest. The first covers the October 5th Los Angeles rally and march to stop the discharge of Fukushima wastewater. About 25 Korean Americans, including four South Koreans who came from Seoul, participated in the rally. And just up is the October 7th Washington, D.C. rally and march to stop the discharge of Fukushima wastewater. Korean Americans from Washington, D.C., New York, New Jersey, plus the four South Koreans attended the rally. Both videos will be up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 694. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 8, 2024. The nuclear story keeps unfolding every week with lots of ins and outs and permutations and bits and pieces that you deserve to know about. We try to cover as many of them as we can here on Nuclear Hot Seat. So if you'd like to not miss out on a single episode and would like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy for you. You can sign up at nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow box that pops up. You really can't miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, just one, email from us with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. You can also sign up on your favorite podcast channel, but if you do it through the website, we get credit on the Google algorithms. And that's what we're going for, because the higher we rank there, the more people actually get exposed to the show. But either way, you'll be guaranteeing that you never get left out of the nuclear news loop. Now, you probably know things that I don't about nuclear, and I want to know them. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to nuclearhotseat.com and donate, we really need your help. Anything helps, everything helps, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevy, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevy of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that luck is a terrible safety plan when it comes to anything nuclear. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because truly, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat.
What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.